Welcome, welcome, welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Thank you as ever for joining us. It's always a privilege to have you. Today, I am very privileged to introduce an ex-colleague of mine, Mrs. Holly Reynolds. Sorry, Mike. She's definitely married. Holly is someone that I did peer support work alongside and had a very similar journey to me into this kind of work, in that she had her own experience, as a lot of people do, and she wants to share and change outcomes for other people with that. Holly has been candidly honest about her story, and in this conversation we talk about her whole experience through hyperemesis through to postnatal anxiety and depression, how she got through that, what her support networks look like. And I think what's really interesting about this one is identifying where the holes were and how she got there. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. I'll leave you to myself and Holly talking, and we'll see you on the other side. So welcome to today's Born Human podcast. Today, I have the wonderful Holly Reynolds with me, somebody who I've been lucky enough to do peer support with for parents over the last few years. Holly has been a massive support to me, but the one thing that we have in common is that we've both shared our own journeys in parenthood, and I guess that brought us together in some ways. So welcome aboard, Holly. Thanks
for
coming on.
Thank you for
having me. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good, that's good to know.
Yeah, it's a lovely sunny day. So
it is.
Yeah. Feeling good.
Good. Excellent. So Holly's been on her journey in parenthood, and it's, as ever, it's not for me to drive what that looks like, but we're just going to explore that and see what it was like for her and what she's been through. So how old were you when you decided to wanted to have children, and what was that look like?
So I guess right from being a kid myself, I loved like playing role play and being mum, and I had a little sister and brother, so I'd always be the mum or the teacher or the kind of one in charge and bossing everybody around.
I get that, Holly.
Yeah. But yeah, so I had like a really happy sort of family unit, and a lovely childhood. So my experience of being part of a family and a sibling was always, you know, quite a positive one.
Yeah.
And you know, with my little sister and brother, it was, I always knew I had mates that I'd always grow up with, and we used to fight, but then when it came down to it, we were like the best of friends.
Yeah.
So I always knew that I wanted a family, and I probably wanted quite a big family, so a few children.
Yeah.
Right from, you know, when I was really young. Yeah.
And who was the lucky man?
Oh, I'm not sure I'd call him lucky. So my husband Mike, got to go on that journey with me. Yeah, and we actually met when we were quite young. So we were 15.
Childhood sweethearts.
Yeah, well, yeah. So we were childhood sweethearts, but he was, I was 15, and I wanted a bad boy. And Mike, if anyone knows Mike, he's not a bad boy. He's a really nice man.
He is, yeah.
Yeah. And we were in a relationship for probably just short of a year, and I was looking for something, a bad boy, basically.
More dangerous.
More dangerous. And I told him that, and I said, you're the sort of person I'd like to marry one day, but right now, and we kind of went our separate ways and were in relationships. And then I went to Ibiza after a big split up from an ex. I was like, right, that's it, I'm going to Ibiza. And I went with a friend, and we were going to do a season out there. And then one night I got very intoxicated with alcohol and just randomly text Mike, and this is like 4 years later, and he had the same number, and I won't say what was in the text message. But we met up when I got back, and the rest is history, I guess. So yeah, we were, I think I was coming up to 20 when we kind of reconnected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's amazing. Like, I think, like, how you go from, like, you kind of need to know what you don't want in some ways, and also have the chance to know that you don't want it, you know? Like, it's, if you're just given, I mean, I know Mike, you know, I've met Mike, and I've sort of had dealings with Mike, and I think he's, I completely see why you married him.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you have that sort of nagging doubt in your mind, it's like, well,
I want a bad boy or whatever, then it's like, I need to know that bad boys aren't good for me in the long run and just get them out of my system kind of thing.
So we, and things happened quite quickly. So we met back up, and then I was at uni, I went to uni, and we moved in together, and then we got engaged when I was still at uni. Finished uni, bought our first house, and then got married, all within sort of 18 months, and fell pregnant, so all within a very, very short space of time. So we were quite young when we kind of fell pregnant and had Darcy, so...
It's, well, when you know it's right, you know it's right.
And Mike came from a big family. So he's one of five children. Unfortunately, he lost his mum when he was really young, but I think he always knew that he wanted a family. So it was kind of always in the plan.
You both knew where you were at, kind of thing. That's cool. So it was pretty, you were pretty young, but how was pregnancy for you?
So I was really unfortunate in that I suffered with hyperemesis. So I was really quite poorly with kind of severe morning sickness. So this kind of image of blooming and being really excited about being pregnant. And I remember having conversations with my mum before I was pregnant, like, what is it like? And, oh, we'll be able to go shopping. And it was all the kind of lovely, floaty, butterfly, like, image of what it would be like to be pregnant. And actually for me, I was just in bed most of the time. Or sort of, we had a bathroom right next to our bedroom, so it, I was living between bedroom, bathroom, and I was sick all
for the whole pregnancy. I mean, it's such a crippling condition, that right? And it's, I think it's unreasonable in many ways that people kind of refer to it as extreme morning sickness. It was that, funny enough, I'm talking to somebody else about coming on here to talk about that specifically, and just that sense of, like, when you talk about it as morning sickness, presumably from what I hear of it and the people I've met, including yourself now, there's a sense of, like, don't just call it morning sickness, because it's really not morning sickness, you know, like the dehydration that you can go through, like the potential hospital admissions,
and actually, you know, the psychological impact that it had. So there was, I think, looking back now, my kind of difficulty with that transition into parenthood started way back in pregnancy, and at the time I didn't really recognize it as that. But it was the little things, like having to tell my boss I couldn't come to work because I was being sick, and they knew that I was pregnant, so they were just, oh, she's off with morning sickness. But it wasn't morning sickness, it was so much more than that. And kind of having thoughts like, why have I done this, why am I pregnant, I don't want to be pregnant, and, you know, really not wanting to say that to anybody. Like, I couldn't say to anybody, like, I wish I wasn't pregnant, because I felt really lucky to be pregnant. And we didn't, so kind of rewind a little bit, when we were trying for a baby, I wasn't sure if it'd be that easy because I had polycystic ovarian syndrome. So I knew for quite a while that it might be a little bit more tricky for us to conceive, or might take a bit longer. And that we might need some intervention, but luckily we didn't. But so I felt really so lucky and blessed that I was pregnant. But then on the other hand, I was kind of like, I really didn't think I could get through 9 months of being this poorly.
And I mean, polycystic ovaries is also really common, right? Like, Lucy had that. And like, the more people you talk to about it, it's like, yeah, I've got polycystic ovaries. And you're like, Jesus, like, everyone have it, kind of thing. And it's not, I know it's not, but it's also another subject that's not talked about, right? So you can kind of start to see why a journey starts in one way and ends in a different way, right? So it went all for the whole 9 months, kind of thing. Did you ever, were you ever admitted to hospital or anything like that?
So I wasn't admitted to hospital. There was a point where I think they thought if I couldn't get enough fluids down, then I'd have to go into hospital or keep enough fluids down. But I was given some medication, which sort of took the edge off a little bit. But again, like, during that time, I kind of felt I wanted someone to say, right, let's take you in and just sort of get you to a place where you can go home and not feel as awful. I don't know how they would have done that, but I just sort of felt like I was managing it on my own. So Mike was obviously working, and I was just at home on my own all the time, being sick, feeling dreadful, not able to go out and enjoy my pregnancy, or so that was horrible. And I don't know if we're going to talk about antenatal classes.
We can do whatever we want.
But I remember going to an antenatal class, and everyone seemed to be, you know, just bossing it, and I just looked like hell. And I remember at the end there was like, because I was feeling quite low, and I'd not really sort of talked about it with anybody, and I'd heard about sort of postnatal depression and stuff, and I was sort of worrying that I was going to get postnatal depression. And at the end of this antenatal class, they didn't really touch on mood or anything like that.
Yeah.
They said, oh, is there any questions? And I put my hand up and I said, you know, what happens if you start to feel like low, or you're, you know, feeling suicidal after you've had your baby? And it's something that sticks with me, and it's something that's only really I've thought about recently. And I remember this midwife, and I can understand to some extent why she said what she did, but then it kind of reinforced this stigma around mental health. But she said, oh, we'll talk, I can talk to you about that on your own in a minute if you like.
Right.
We won't talk about it in the group. And I kind of thought, at the time, I was like, oh, okay. And at the time, I didn't know I was going to get so unwell.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, whoa.
What's wrong with me?
Yeah. And why can we not talk about this? We talk about all the physical ailments of pregnancy and having a baby. And we've talked about birth and, you know, all the different types of birth.
Nappy changing and carrying a sling or whatever. Yeah.
But we're not talking about, well, what if we're not feeling right in our mood? And I just remember thinking, oh, and then it kind of reinforced to me, oh God, everyone must think, why is she asking that question?
Yeah.
And then I felt a bit ostracized from
the group.
From it. Yeah. Like it was like, you know, we shouldn't be talking about that. And it's again, like at the time it was kind of like, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't have asked that question. Maybe that was a bit too much.
Yeah.
But now in my life,
in the fullness of knowing what you know.
Yeah. You know, I'd really encourage people to ask that question.
Yeah.
And talk about it, because it's real. It's just, it's a feeling. It's something that we all go through. And why is it, why did she? And again, like, through lots of therapy, we know that people respond to certain things because maybe they don't feel comfortable talking about it or whatever. So, you know, I give her the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think in that environment, that I think that that's a really important question. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like you're in this sort of, certainly in your case, going from trying to be pregnant with polycystic ovaries to hyperemesis, which is blatantly going to affect your mood. I don't see any way it wouldn't to anyone. Kind of, and we've all been locked down for the last year and a half or whatever. So in that respect, kind of thing, everyone's felt the pain of like not being able to do what you want to do, let alone not being able to enjoy a pregnancy and coming to terms with the fact you're going to be a family and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's perfectly reasonable to assume that that might affect your brain. I'm interested, what did she say to you when she took you to one side? She didn't actually talk about it.
No, so we just left. We left the antenatal class. She didn't sort of pull me aside, and I didn't feel that I could then go to her because it was kind of like, oh no, we can't talk about that here. So I didn't feel comfortable then talking to her about that.
Felt more like it was brushing it under the carpet rather than deferring it and talking about it
separately.
And
I suppose in a way I kind of felt like, okay, yeah, that's fine. Let's just brush it under the carpet.
Yeah. Well, it reinforces your fear, I suppose, doesn't it? Of talking about, we've talked about this so many times, but like the whole sort of difference between mental and physical health. And if you've got a broken arm, I can see it, I can feel it, I can watch it recovering, I can see it getting better. But when it's in your head, it's like, is it real? Is it not real? What, you know, what, do you feel the same way I felt? Or, and actually, it doesn't matter.
No.
Because your own truth is what you're experiencing, right? And, you know, by kind of, you know, reinforcing the fact that we shouldn't, you know, if we don't talk about it, you know, the old standards, aren't they? They're the wrong standards to be following in this day and age, I suppose.
But
so that kind of reinforced your situation, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think maybe as time went on, and then I went on to sort of have Darcy, it was that sort of, and again, it's things that I've only really started to think about lately. And because I'm in a good place, I can really kind of digest it and process it.
Mm.
And, you know, Darcy's nearly 10. So, so it was a long time ago. And I'd hope that with the kind of, you know, development in perinatal mental health services, things have changed.
Yeah.
And I think I did notice a bit of a difference when I had Rex 5 years later. But I think it kind of reinforced that status within professionals as well. Yeah. So I didn't know how to talk to them about how I was feeling, because it was kind of like, yeah, it didn't feel sort of, I was the patient.
Yeah.
Not, you know, I felt like I was the patient.
Student, not a teacher.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, antenatal education is a bit like that, isn't it? There's like this sense of like empowering you to, I remember when we had Wilbur going in and like coming out of antenatal feeling like, yes, I'm empowered. Mm. Lucy doesn't want any drugs. Mm. If the doctor says drugs, I say no, because Lucy says no.
Yeah.
And then we were kind of like, okay, the baby's heart rate's dropping, you need to come in now. Mm. And it was like, okay, suddenly I'm rubbing the headlights. And they're like, we need to get her on some medication. And I was like, I thought I was empowered to say something about this, but I'm not now. Yeah. And like, there's a falsehood in that, which is like, not that you can't, and not that you shouldn't be your partner's advocate if they're going through that, and you shouldn't be able to try and respect what they wanted beforehand, but pregnancy and birth are nature's way. It's not our choice how it happens, right? And so unless you've prepared for every single situation, which fundamentally there's too many of them to count, you can't be prepared for it, right? And so you need that sort of flexibility to be able to react and work with them rather than kind of... The sense I always got from antenatal was like, you know, just stand up and be strong and just tell them what you want. And it's like, they're not the enemy here. Yeah. The whole point is that we're all working together to end up with a baby, right? So how was it when you finally got around to having Darcy? How was that?
So... It was, I think the only word I can use is it was traumatic. It was a really traumatic experience where I felt like, I suppose, like a prisoner within my own body. I just completely felt out of control. And it was that loss of control, and I didn't feel heard, and I can't really, that whole kind of experience was a bit of a blur, but the main things I pick out from that weren't very nice.
Yeah.
And you know, I kind of grew up, my mum's a bit of a warrior, and she's so, incredible, but I always remember talking to my mum about way before I was pregnant about her births and stuff, and she did it all on gas and air, and you know, it wasn't easy for her. She had some really unfortunate things sort of happen for her, but she did it all on gas and air. So I was kind of like, well, I'll be doing it on gas and air then.
That's my role model.
I'm a Thomas you know, before I was a Reynolds. I'll just, you know, be gas and air and that's fine. And my mum is this tiny little, like, delicate lady, just so diddy. Like, I definitely take after my dad. She's just got this tiny little frame. And I thought, you know, if her body can do it, mine can do it. Like, I'm a brute. Like, I'll be fine. I remember we were at my mum's, and the contractions started. We went into hospital, and you know, as we, a lot of things, you know, first time mum, go home, you know, rest, have a bath, and you know, when it starts to get a bit more intense and closer together, phone us back or whatever. So we went back home, and we thought, we'll go back to my mum and dad's because they live closer to the hospital, and they've just ordered a Chinese, so everyone was eating Chinese, and I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't be in Chinese. I'm not sure. And then I had a bath, and that was all quite relaxed. And then it started to get quite intense, so we went into hospital, and I remember my waters went in the bath, so I was having a bath, and that was a bit like, oh my! As soon as my waters went, it's like, this is actually happening.
Yeah.
And up until then, it was kind of like, okay, yeah, we're all right. And then it's when my body then started to just like do all this stuff. And I was like, what is happening? And I couldn't control it. And I desperately wanted some pain relief.
Yeah.
And I remember being examined, and they were sort of like, oh, you know, things are going quite quickly. You're doing really well.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'll just give me some gas and air. So I was taking the gas and air, and that made me feel a bit spaced out. And I was like, please, I really, really need an epidural. I cannot do this. I was like, every part of me was out of control. I was screaming. My body was like just I couldn't get comfortable, and it was this real physical. Yeah, I just felt like I did not have control of my body, and all the breathing and all the trying to think of, you know, nice things, it was just all going out the window. And I didn't know at the time, but because I was progressing quite quickly and things were, you know, happening,
yeah,
the midwife, who I think was trying to be really supportive, said to my husband, sort of aside, you know, she's doing really well. If we give her an epidural now, it's really going to slow things down.
You're right.
And I think he felt quite powerless because she was the professional.
Yeah.
And actually, ultimately, what happened then is things did progress really quickly. And I delivered Darcy, and then I had a third degree tear,
right.
Which was really traumatic. And then I was whisked straight down to surgery.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that skin to skin time with her.
Yeah.
I was still kind of like, what has just happened?
Yeah.
And I didn't feel that I got anything from it because I'd just gone straight
just
down.
Just been
into
taken
surgery.
Away kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And the things running through my mind were like, who's got her? Who's going to put her, like, who's going to put a first set of clues on her?
Yeah.
It's not going to be me. And it seems like a really small thing, but actually that was like massive for
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
I took in like her little outfit for that we would dress her in when she was born. And actually that wasn't going to be me doing that. And
yeah.
Although it would be Mike and that's absolutely perfectly fine. Yeah. That was something we were going to do together.
Yeah.
And I just remember going down in this big light and, bearing in mind, something I should have sort of said before is I'd never been in hospital for anything before.
Oh, really?
So I'd broken my arm. That's as far as it went when I was 9.
Yeah.
But I'd not kind of had any big operations at this point. I'd not had to have any inpatient stay in hospital.
Yeah.
So everything about being in a delivery suite was completely alien to me.
Yeah.
The sounds, the smells, the language that was being used about what was happening to my body, where we were at. It was like being in like a movie and I had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
And I remember going down and I was thinking, third degree tear, that sounds quite bad.
Yeah.
But no one was sort of explaining what that actually meant.
It's just a title.
It's just a title. And I'm thinking, okay, so third degree. So there must be a first degree, a second degree. So is first degree worse? Or
yeah, which way around is it?
Where am
yeah,
I?
Yeah.
And I remember kind of being led out and feeling really vulnerable and lost. And my husband wasn't there.
Alone, right?
Really
just you
alone.
And
yeah, and all these people in blue.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite a invasive surgery and you're awake and... I was thinking, oh my God, what does this mean? And then I'm thinking, where's my baby? And I was exhausted because
yeah,
I'd
yeah.
just been through birth.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was wheeled up to recovery and my baby was there and I knew she was my baby, but I hadn't had that moment of, oh, I love you so much.
Yeah, yeah.
All the endorphins that everyone told me would happen. And yeah. when they put that baby on your chest, you just fall in love. And even my mum said that to me. And,
yeah.
you know, like, oh, yeah, I remember they put you in my arms and it was just like everything else floated away. And I hadn't had that. So I started to panic. And I was like, why am I not feeling this?
Yeah.
It was just kind of like I was taken up to recovery. I was still exhausted. I hadn't had anything to eat.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, okay. And at no point is anyone... I felt like I needed a plan.
Yeah.
Like, so this has happened. Like a debrief. This has happened. You're really going to be sore. You've been fitted with a catheter. So you're not going to be able to get up and go for a wee.
Yeah.
It was just all done. And
yeah.
I was like, okay. Couldn't pick up my baby. And then, you know, my mum was holding her, which is, again, like, absolutely fine. Like, but I should have been holding her.
You've carried her for 9 months.
Yeah, and that first cuddle, and again, these are only things really now, kind of as time's gone on. And I really think about what happened after when I became unwell, like all the little things that would have contributed to that.
Yeah.
I didn't really think of at the time,
yeah.
but I kind of, you know, have worked through it now. But just little things like that, and that Mike had to go home. Luckily, they let my mum stay.
Yeah.
But I didn't sleep and I wasn't feeling all these things that I thought that I should be feeling. And I was frightened to death of taking her home.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of all the ways I could maybe just stay a little bit longer in hospital and get some help.
Yeah.
breastfeeding wasn't working.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm really rambling now.
Not at all. No, this is your story and it's all kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so it was all just a bit like, it wasn't what I expected. So this kind of picturesque, I would be breastfeeding my baby and we'd be out of hospital and home and as a family and it would all be lovely and we'd be a family of three. And
yeah,
that was that. It wasn't really going down that road.
Yeah.
And my breast milk didn't come in. And then I had this healthcare assistant again, like, bless her, she must have been just 18 maybe.
Right.
Maybe her first little job within healthcare.
Yeah.
And she came over with a syringe and to help me get some milk off the colostrum.
Yeah.
And she was like manipulating my breast and my boob. And I was like, this is so weird. And why am I letting you do this to me?
Yeah.
But I felt so helpless. And yeah, I was, and it was just really surreal. And then after I, like, as time's gone on again, it's like, I never let someone do
that. Yeah. There was like you could have had a different outcome.
Yeah. Kind of, and what she was doing was kind of necessary, but I felt that it wasn't in my hands. It was kind of like, right, we're going to do this and we're going to syringe some colostrum off. But I wasn't doing it, and it was my body. And it was kind of like, why is everyone doing stuff to my body?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So
there was no sort of, feels like there was a whole lot of consultation missing in terms of, I think by the sound of things, a lot of it would have happened. There's not a lot, you know, they want to keep you alive, look after you, all of that. And you'd have been cool with the fact they wanted to keep you alive so you can see your baby and look after her.
Yeah.
And kind of get the colostrum and stuff. But I suppose it's the way in which that's done, right? Whether you're kind of dragged to it, or that sounds a horrible term, but you know what I mean? Or sort of like told that's how it's going to be. Or whether someone says, like you say, you'd be given a plan and you're explained it.
Mm.
And the difference that makes, I suppose that's, and this is by no means a negative reflection on the NHS in, collectively, but there's that bedside manners, such a delicate thing, isn't it? You know, and you go from like one doctor to another delivering exactly the same message.
Yeah.
All with the best intentions, I'm sure, but just with different styles.
Mm.
And as people, we receive things differently, right? And we take them differently. But it sounds like, you know, it was one after the other for you. That when it was like, it becomes cumulative, right?
Yeah. So it was just, it felt like one negative experience after the other. And then what followed was kind of like just pretty bad. So we went home and the first couple of days were okay. I was managing to breastfeed, but I knew I wasn't doing it right. I knew we weren't getting it right, me and Darcy, because I was so sore and I was dreading every time I'd have to put her on the breast. But again, my mum, bless her, breastfed all of us and she could do it. So I should be able to do it. And, you know, and I had support. So it wasn't that no one was pushing me. No one was forcing me to do it. I really wanted to breastfeed.
Yeah.
That was kind of the plan. And I had all these lovely visions of breastfeeding and feeling really empowered and, you know, I felt that's what my body should have done.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't working. And one night, I think we were about 10 days in and I was starting to feel really anxious about everything. And it wasn't just about the baby. It was like that I put the biscuits in the wrong cupboard.
Right.
And it was really random. And I would just lie there at night and I couldn't fall asleep because I was panicking that I'd put biscuits in the wrong cupboard.
Yeah.
Just really irrational. And then we weren't sleeping because Darcy wasn't sleeping because she wasn't feeding properly.
Yeah.
And I remember I just fed her. It was a middle of the night, about 11 o'clock at night. And I winded her and she brought up a load of blood. And straight away, I'm like, oh no, this is really bad. Something's really wrong. So we went to the local walk-in centre and the doctor was really reassuring. She checked Darcy, did all of her obs and, you know, vitals and things were perfect. She was lovely, all fine. And she said, I think that maybe the blood's come from you.
Right.
So can I examine you? So she examined me and, you know, without being too graphic, my nipples were hanging off and you could see the fat behind them. Sorry, that's quite graphic.
It's the truth.
And she said, oh yeah, it's definitely come from you. But, you know, persevere with it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I think in that moment, all I wanted her to say was, do you know what? It looks like you've had a really tough time of this. How do you feel about maybe getting some formula and giving your boobs a rest and maybe trying again in a few days, or just like letting them heal? Or...
But taking control back a little bit. Yeah, right?
But no, so I went home and then I thought, okay, well, you know, even though I'm really struggling, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I like rules and I don't ever want to be in trouble for anything or do anything wrong.
Yeah.
I've always kind of felt like that. I've always been, you know, little Holly has to stick to the rules and, you know, did not like getting in trouble as a child, would never be on the wrong side of the law. Although I did like a bad boy.
Let the bad boys do that, yeah.
But yeah, so I guess that then reinforced that maybe, I don't know, I felt that I wasn't, it was all about Darcy, which was fine because she was my baby and I knew I loved her and I wanted her to be okay.
Yeah.
But everything was about Darcy.
Yeah.
And then because I was lacking in sleep and I was exhausted, I'd then feel resentful towards Darcy and I knew I loved her, but I couldn't feel it because everything that I was doing was for Darcy, but it was
at my expense.
And the hours I've spent kind of going over that and how actually, simple fact was my needs weren't being met at that time. My basic needs, I wasn't able to meet my basic needs.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating because I was too anxious to eat. I wasn't able to kind of get myself dressed and washed and because I just didn't have time.
Yeah.
And then it progressively got worse from there, where these kind of horrible feelings of guilt and resentment then turned into really intrusive thoughts. Okay. So my anxiety really picked up a notch and I'd have some really horrible intrusive thoughts about things happening to Darcy or something happening to me or me losing control. And I then started to believe it. So I would avoid picking her up or I wouldn't feed her. And so we put her on a bottle in the end, we got formula. And I thought that would help because I'd have a rest.
Yeah.
But by that point, my anxiety was, I was so on high alert all the time. I couldn't switch off. I couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
And I had this beautiful, and I talk about this quite a lot. And when I've spoken to sort of professionals and I've done talks on kind of my experience and it's something that always sticks out. And it's this, I had this beautiful blanket from Mamas and Papas and it was like the one thing throughout pregnancy that I was just so excited about.
Yeah.
Because it was like a really nice blanket and she was my first baby and I couldn't wait to kind of have this little blanket and all these like visions of, you know, going out for a walk and this lovely blanket. And it was really special.
Yeah.
And actually this blanket became quite a horrible part of my story because I would just have awful things happening with this blanket.
Oh, wow.
And I would hide the blanket.
Right.
And I started to kind of pick up little behaviours because I was so frightened that I was going to do something awful. Not because I wanted to or I was planning to, but just because these horrible intrusive thoughts were coming in.
Yeah.
And I had no idea where they were coming from. So I started to think, well, maybe I am a really bad person.
Yeah.
And how do I tell someone? Because I wanted to keep her safe, but for me to keep her safe, I had to be away from her.
Yeah.
So I knew I loved her. I was finding it really hard to access that emotion. But I thought that I was the problem. I was the one ultimately that was, you know, malfunctioning.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Mike and my mum started to pick up on this.
Yeah.
And I'd tell them little snippets and they'd be like, oh, Holly, you're exhausted. You're going to, you know, you're going to feel these things sometimes. But I wasn't maybe as truthful. And then when I finally did, it was like verbal diarrhea and it all came out and all these horrible thoughts and feelings. And do you know what? Fair play to Mike and my mum because they kept a poker face. They weren't like panicked. And I don't know where that came from because they've never experienced anything like that before. Someone disclosing some really dark stuff. But it was kind of like, okay, right, I think we need to speak to someone.
Yeah.
And that night I think I disclosed all this stuff and I was panicking that I was going to go to jail. Something bad was going to happen to Darcy. Like, all these crazy things were coming out of, like, my brain. And I just thought it was kind of like, what happens now? And it, you know, it was, I phoned my local psychiatric unit to try and get admitted. And I don't really think they understood what I was asking. So I phoned the Samaritans and I was on the phone to a man, which was fine. But I was like, I need to speak to a woman. I need to speak to someone who's going to understand this.
Yeah.
There were no women on at that time in the night.
Right.
And I was just like, I just don't, what is happening? And I really didn't know what to do. And my mum called my health visitor the next morning because I disclosed to my mum that I was on the phone to the Samaritans and I needed help. I needed someone to take me away.
Yeah.
I needed to be away from Darcy. And my health visitor got me an emergency appointment with our psychiatric assessment unit, which is really local. And, you know, if you could imagine the things that were going through my head, I was just frightened to death of going to this psychiatric unit because I thought they're going to section me. I'm going to get like locked up. But in a way, I kind of wanted that because I felt that that would make me safe. And I hadn't slept for 4 days, so 4 straight days of no sleep, which is very dangerous. And the psychiatrist, Dr. Connor, his name was just incredible. And he just listened and didn't judge me. And he's like, okay, yeah. And everything I was saying, he wasn't like, oh, okay, so when you have these thoughts, do you want to do it? It was kind of initially... He just listened.
Yeah.
And that's what I needed. I just needed a professional to listen to me.
Yeah.
And actually feel heard.
Yeah.
And then he then went on, did a referral to the Bristol Mother and Baby Unit. And back then, it ran quite differently. So there was you could be a day patient. So you'd go up every day.
Yeah.
Because they only had 4 beds. Because we moved in with my mum and dad for some extra support. They said, you can come up as a day patient. So I started to get support there. I made contact with a charity called House of Light, and they were based up in Hull, but they had a 24-hour telephone sort of helpline.
Yeah.
And this lady was amazing, and she presented when she was unwell. She presented really similar to the things that I was presenting with.
Yeah.
So talking to her, and she was like really successful now. She'd set up her own charity.
Yeah.
She was doing really well. And I was thinking, okay, right, I could probably get better from this.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
I'd have days and I'd think, no, I've got something different to what everybody else has.
Yeah.
This isn't postnatal illness. This isn't, you know, postnatal anxiety. I'm actually just wired wrong. And then I'd have a good day. And then the journey kind of just went on from there. But it was really hard for all of us and for Mike and for my mum and dad. It was just, but I think once I felt heard, even though I was in at my darkest point, it kind of felt like, okay, a door's just opened.
Yeah.
And there is a plan.
I can start climbing some stairs now.
Yeah. And I was on some medication as well. Which again, like I was like, I'm never going on medication, but in that moment, that's what I needed. Although unfortunately, when the medication started, I wasn't aware that things might get worse before they got better.
Okay.
So this was prior to my crisis, I suppose I'd call it. They put me on some medication and it got a lot worse. And then I suppose maybe that increased anxiety kind of triggered the lack of the unable to fall to sleep and eat and all of that stuff. So that was a bit tricky. So I was given some more medication to counteract that. So I was like taking loads of medication.
More and more.
Yeah. But in that moment, I suppose, you know, that's what I needed at that time. Yeah. And then I was able to then access, you know, really tailored sort of support from the mother and baby unit. Yeah. Sorry.
Wow.
Just basically.
But you can see, right? Like, I mean, you know, I obviously knew your story from knowing you, but you just recounting it in that relatively short period of time and seeing all the impacts of each stage of it, and you think it's not really a surprise in some respects that all those factors might contribute to you ending up in a bad place, right? And actually, what opportunities are you given to kind of process any of that? Or it's so not clear, but like there are so many points where you could say, well, if you'd have been given more support there and there and there, you might have had a different outcome, right?
And do you know what? Only recently, in a kind of supervision environment, someone that was giving me my supervisions made me realise something that I'd not maybe thought of before, and it was that vulnerability can actually be a bit of a superpower. So being vulnerable isn't necessarily a weakness. And I always thought, you know, you've got to be strong and independent, and that's how I was brought up. And you know, my dad was in the police force, so it was kind of, that was the way. And you know, we stick to the rules, and we, you know, we're good people, we're good members of society. And but you know, if you're struggling, you know, you need to just kind of, you know, you've got a really good life, you've got a good family behind you, everything's all right,
be grateful, you'll work it out,
yeah, it'll be all right, it'll be fine. But actually, I just needed someone to say, Holly, it's all right to cry and feel really crap because of everything you've been through. And I wonder if maybe, and I'm not sure if that would be appropriate, but you know, after that experience maybe of my birth, someone saying, Holly, if you start to feel, you know, really like low or anxious, or you start reliving what has happened, that is maybe expected because that was really traumatic for you. So don't be afraid if that happens, but you need to talk to somebody. Whereas I was like, I can't tell anybody what I'm thinking or this have, because it might mean that I've got a mental illness. Or, you know, and I can't have a mental illness. I'm not the sort of person that would get a mental illness. And that was kind of my outlook. So I was really scared of mental illness. Which I suppose almost fed this fire of anxiety, because it was almost like every time I was anxious, I was just like, I'm going mad. Like, I'm really, you know, I'm not, I felt like I was going mad, I think. And And this is just like a snippet of the story. There's so much more that I could tell you. And I look back and I'm like, oh, wow.
And it doesn't sound like the only two points that it sounds like to me from memory, that from listening to it, that felt like it was normalised was when Mike and your mum were listening to you and just hearing you. And when you heard the lady from on the support line kind of going through a similar thing. And in both of those instances, what you're really asking for is for somebody to just not judge you, but hear what you're going through, right?
And the psychiatrist. So he was a professional. And I think I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go and see the best of the best. Like, I'm seeing a psychiatrist and he's going to fix me. And I thought, you know, he's going to give me all of these things, some medication, you know, some therapy, and he's going to fix me. But actually what he did was no one could fix me. That was me. I had to do all that hard work, but he just listened and understood and heard my story. And it wasn't the behaviour that was going on right there, but everything that had led up to me being in that room with him that day.
Yeah.
And I think the difference was he had time to be able to listen to my story and not just fix the anxiety that was happening in that moment. It was kind of like, okay, let's pull this apart a little bit and see where this is all coming from.
And just think bigger picture by the sound of things.
Yeah.
Kind of see the whole picture and not be frightened by what you're delivering in that moment, and just try and sort of make an instant fix of that part, you know?
Which is scary in a way, because I think I was really lucky to have my mum and Mike, who were so supportive, and they knew that I needed help. So they reached out to the health visitor. The health visitor then reached out to the psychiatrist. But actually, some people don't have that.
Yeah.
Like, some people will struggle with that for a long, long time with no help. And, you know, the impact of that can be catastrophic. And I just think I was one of the lucky ones, you know, that had the support. And I appreciate that not everybody has that. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about what I do now in my role as a peer support worker, is just holding that space for someone to just say it.
And just listen and be that person that, you know,
that I needed,
that you needed, right? Because you know what it felt like. And I think that's the power of it, isn't it, really? And I, you know, I, I have so much respect for everything you do and that we've done together and all those kind of things, because I think they're, you're just applying your humanity to other people and saying, it's not rocket science. What I'm trying to create for you here is just somewhere where you can be heard in a way that...
Yeah.
And having had your experience, like, it's not like a... There's little, I always think anyway, and you may feel differently because I haven't been through that. But that sense of like, if I've been through that and nothing good comes of it, not what was the point, but I might as well turn it into something decent for somebody else, you know, because I can't change what's happened, but I can use that to kind of leverage the outcome for somebody else. Yeah.
I remember really early on in my recovery when I started to have the good days, because it wasn't like a switch and then I was better. It was a long, long sort of, for me, it felt a really long route to recovery, and it's about 9 months, I think.
Okay.
Which is fairly short, really, when you think about everything that happened. But it was about 9 months where I started to feel like, actually, yeah, I can be a mum.
Yeah.
I can enjoy this, and I can, and very early on, I sort of knew that my, somewhere in my life, sort of further down the line, I wanted to be that person, to just listen and hold that space and be there. And it took, 8 years for me to get to that place, to be able to actually be far enough away from my experience to be able to do that role. But it's a really powerful position. Not powerful position, it's a powerful thing to be able to offer somebody. It's like magic.
Yeah. And it is, because you can't, all those times when you're sitting there thinking you don't understand, like when you were speaking to the Samaritans, it's like, I need to speak to a woman, because I think she'll have, you know, even if she's not been through what I've been through, she might have had children or she might get some of it, you know.
Yeah.
You're looking for those hooks, aren't you? In somebody going, that's really tough, but I do get it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I do get it is like a... such a simple phrase, but when it's said by somebody who really does get it, it's like you can feel the wash sort of just be like, okay, well, I feel like I've let go of some of that now.
Yeah.
Not let go of it completely, but you've sort of had the capacity to be able to say, they get it. It doesn't feel as heavy anymore.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
Yeah. And how, so did they ever, was it ever sort of formally labelled or diagnosed or anything like that?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with postnatal depression.
Okay, yeah.
Or severe postnatal anxiety.
Yeah.
Because I was kind of like, I've not got postnatal depression, I'm not depressed. I'm just really anxious about everything. But actually, I think the depression was feeding the anxiety.
Okay.
And then eventually, I kind of went through a stage of just being depressed.
Yeah.
And then the anxiety has subsided. And it was this real roller coaster of, like, I'd be okay for... It started off, I'd be okay for like an hour, and I'd be like, okay, I've just had a really good hour, and I'd feel really empowered in that hour, and then it would just be like, oh, and then I'd feel rubbish, and then I'd have maybe like a good day, but then two bad days, and then maybe two good days, and then just a really awful week, but just eventually the good days would outweigh the bad days, and I kept like a little calendar, and I'd colour it in, and I could see my progress, and I'm quite a visual person, so being able to see, okay, yeah, the good days are getting more and more, and what was a... good day, what was a bad day, hang on, what was a bad day like further on in my journey would have been a really good day at the start.
Yeah.
So it was like, and I could feel it, and I could feel a shift and a difference in my relationship. And I think what is really important around anything when we talk about kind of perinatal mental health is the impact it has on the infant.
Yeah.
And what was going on for Darcy at that time. And I was really lucky to get all the support and the help that I did, because it meant that I could actually work on that, those feelings that I was so desperate to feel for her.
Yeah.
So through therapy, and I did some work, me and Darcy. So like, it was like mother and baby therapy, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I remember the moment that I felt that rush of love, and actually that was bigger than I think anything I would have felt if it would have been on the day, because of everything we've been through together.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that it was about me and Darcy, and people were, I think I was really worried that people thought I wasn't capable, because I knew I was capable, but I just didn't have the capacity at that moment to be it. to be a good mum. Although now I look back and I'm like, I was a bloody good mum because I was working so hard on my mental health to get better. But yeah, I remember the moment, and we were in this mother and baby class at the mother and baby unit, and it was funny because it was a mother and baby dance class, and I was like, you would not get me into a mother and baby dance class, floating sort of chiffon around and, you know, being all flouncy. I thought, you know, I feel crackers as it is, you know, get me in there doing that. But I was kind of willing to do whatever it took.
Yeah.
And I went into this room and they'd made it all really lovely. And it was in a hospital, but they'd managed to make this room sort of really therapeutic. And it was all like dim lights and like stars on the walls. And we had all this like chiffon, and we'd start off and we'd do like a bit of baby massage. And then they played some music, and I was just like, they put the music on. I was like, oh no, this is it. I'm going to stand up and like do something.
Give him a pom-pom.
Yeah. And she was like, just stand up. And all I want you to do is just walk around, listen to the music, and just look at your baby. That's all I want you to do. It's like, okay, I'll do it. And they played, and I always recount this in every talk that I do with anybody, because it is like probably the most impactful moment of my whole life. And they played the Goo Goo Dolls, Iris.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like a Goo Goo Dolls fan or anything like that. I didn't even really know the song. And I was just listening. She was just telling me what to do. So I was doing what she told me, listen to the music. And she's like, just really feel the music, listen to the words. And, you know, she knew exactly what she was doing.
Yeah, yeah. When you know the lyrics.
And the lyrics were like, I don't want the world to see me because I don't think that they'd understand.
Yeah.
And I just want you to know who I am. And that was it. Like, I didn't feel understood from what was going on for me. But all I wanted was my baby to know that I was her mum.
Yeah.
And that she was my baby. And I loved her so much. And just in that moment, it was like the flood. It was like this kind of floodgate had opened, and all these emotions just started coming out, and I was like, okay, just feel it, just go with it, it's fine. And it was just such a special moment, and I've got those words on a poster in my bedroom. Yeah. I look at them every day, and that was so impactful. And it wasn't a big thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, you know, some hardcore medication or some really deep sort of therapy.
Yeah.
It was just a moment with me and Darcy that felt really tricky and awkward at the start, but when I just let myself go with it, and it does sound a bit airy fairy and hippie and flouncy, and it's not something I thought that would ever be, you know, something I'd do, but actually it was like the best moment of my life.
And like, you know, music and those and the arts generally can have real power to kind of connect with you. Like, everybody has, like, you know, if you get married, you have a wedding song that kind of sticks with you forever. Mm. And you have, like, I don't know, that music creates moments in time, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know what it is about putting words to music and then going, if you speak those words, they sound totally different to if you sing them or put them together. But that sense of, like, I suppose it creates emotion, right? Mm. And actually what you're trying to do, I know for Lucy, when she had art therapy, she had exactly the same reaction. Mm. She was like, I'm not doing art therapy. Mm. Like, I'm fine, thanks. Mm. But once she got there, like the enthusiasm when she came home after sort of the first session of being like, they get me. Like, they get it, because I was able to explain it in a way where, you know, I could use all these props to kind of explain it. And then all of a sudden you've got this, like, you know, it's tapping into your emotions in a different way, because if you just keep asking somebody, tell me what you're feeling, that might just not be how that person communicates. Yeah. You know?
And it's really hard to articulate how you feel in that moment, because it feels really alien to you anyway. So actually being able to say it, you might not even have the words, you might not even know what language is, like, how to use language to explain how you're feeling.
What you're feeling,
And I think, what was I going to say? Oh, I can't remember now. So much. I think about so much stuff. when we were kind of, like, planning to have a second child, which was not in the plan. So after this experience, it was like, no way. Not doing that way. Because I felt this huge sense of responsibility to my family and Darcy, that, you know, if I went through that again, I've got a little girl to think of.
Yeah.
I couldn't put my parents through it. I couldn't put Mike through it, because Mike was my absolute rock. He did all the night feeds. He gave up so much. And I know he's my husband and that's what we expect. And he should be there for me. But he kind of went over and above all of that.
Yeah,
I can't even begin to explain how much that meant for me. So the thought of kind of voluntarily putting myself in that situation again was just, to me, really stupid.
Yeah.
But Darcy turned 4 and I just remember thinking about her and her life as an only child. And, you know, for some people, being an only child is absolutely, you know, that is their life and it's fine. And for some families, that absolutely works. So I'm not, but for me, it felt, I came from a big family. Mike came from a big family and I knew my what my relationship was like with my sisters and my brothers and my sister and my brother. And I was just thinking, I really want her to have that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I loved her so much. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this for you.
Yeah.
But we need a plan and we need a really robust, good plan in just in case. So I was quite sort of proactive. And before we even conceived, I went to my GP and I said, look, and it was a different GP to who I had before. We lived in a different area. We lived in Baines. So I didn't know what was available. I didn't even know if I'd be able to access the mother and baby unit if I needed to.
Mm.
I knew that it had changed. So they didn't have day patients there. So all these things already were like barriers.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, oh, I don't know. So I went to my GP. Had a really frank discussion with her and said, look, this is the situation. She could see all my notes. And I said, I'm really scared, but deep down, I would go to mediums and get my tarot cards read to tell me, you know, give me some.
It's going
to
be all right.
It's going to be all right. And she showed me this card and it was like, you know, you've grown so much since last time and it, you know, I see you with a happy future. So I
spoke to my GP. This.
Yeah. And she was like, okay, so this is what's available. This is what we can do. She offered me extra appointments. So she offered me appointments, my GP. So she said, when you fall pregnant, we'll have a chat and then we'll book you in again. So it's like, okay. So she actually wants to help me.
Yeah.
And she was really lovely. And again, it was like, I don't know if she'd been through anything before.
Yeah.
But she got it.
Felt like she did.
Yeah. And it felt, and you get that feel, don't you, from people who
when
have been
they
there.
Just get it.
They just get it.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to my midwife and I remember going, so we fell pregnant. So we were like, right, let's do it. And fell pregnant. And I remember that first midwife appointment, I had hypermesis again, which was really powerful.
All the way through.
But because I had Darcy, it was kind of like I had a reason to get up and try and get on with it.
Yeah.
It was still awful. I was still taking medication.
Suppose you weren't as alone.
I wasn't as alone. No, and because I had another group, I had a group of mum friends. I had some really lovely mum friends. So again, like that's another part of the story. And they were these wonderful women who I'm still amazing friends with. And I hope they get to hear this because they created something for me that I would have felt really uncomfortable before. So being in big groups of people, I was always like a best friend. I'd have like one best friend or a best friend over there and someone over there, and they'd all come, but they didn't all know each other, but that was I quite like that.
Pockets of safe spaces.
Yeah. And so I met two women at the mother and baby unit. Sorry, am I taking up loads of time?
No, you're good.
I'm such a rambler.
No.
Two women I met at the mother and baby unit who I class as like my pillars of strength through so many things I've been through in my life, and I would never ever have met them if I hadn't gone into the mother and baby unit. Seeing one of them tonight, I can't
We're
wait
not.
Fish and chips. And she's an incredible woman. They both are. And then I met this group of women when I finally started to integrate back into the community. And I felt brave enough to go to a group. There was this, I went to this baby massage group, and it was really daunting. It was the first group I went to, and I remember being the first mum there because I needed to tell the facilitator that I was like on the edge, not on the edge anymore. I wasn't. This was like really big for me.
Yeah.
And she was lovely. And then these mums came in, and they all looked like they were bossing it, and they had their nice prams, and they were breastfeeding. And I was like, oh god, and I felt like the odd one out. And nearly 10 years later, I'm going on holiday with them next weekend.
Oh, amazing.
And we are such good mates. And we've all been through stuff. And we've all supported each other throughout our kind of parenting journey.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that was something really incredible that came out of that. And they were there when I was pregnant with Rex. So I knew I had that safety as well.
Yeah.
And they'd gone on to have their second child. Most of them had their second baby by now. So I kind of felt really safe with them and I could be really honest with them. And then pregnant with Rex, had all this stuff in place and went in for my 12-week kind of booking appointment. And I'm not massively religious. I believe in something, I don't know what, but I kind of felt like that day someone was looking down on me.
Yeah.
And they gave me this midwife who was just like magic. And I was so scared and I did get really emotional and I said, look, this is massive for us and I really need your support. And she was like, okay, that's fine. And she went over and above her role to make sure that I always had her at an appointment, even when she was based at a different like birthing centre. I was able to go and have my appointment
there. Yeah.
She was just brilliant. And again, she just got it.
Yeah.
And she didn't judge me. And she was really validating of all of my feelings and brilliant. Absolutely amazing. Then I had Rex and I was like, I'm having the epidural. Like,
excuse me, yeah. Epidural, please.
I'd just like to order my epidural now when I walked into the hospital. But my birth experience was incredible with Rex and
yeah.
I had an epidural, which was brilliant for me. It was so calm. It was so lovely. And he came into the world and they put him on me and I had that instant adrenaline and endorphins, which was lovely.
Yeah.
And then from there on, everything was okay. It was hard. It's hard having two kids.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the sleepless nights. I was like, I'm not breastfeeding. We'll go straight to bottle because I know that Mike can help and I can get my sleep.
Yeah.
But they put him on me and he found my breast and he started breastfeeding. And it was just like, okay, this is good.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to put pressure on myself. They let us stay in hospital for two nights. So we had our own kind of little side room, which was really lucky.
Yeah.
And we had a bit of extra support from some midwives who would come in and they'd offer to feed Rex.
So yeah.
We could sleep. Darcy loved having a little brother.
Yeah.
And it was just lush. And that whole experience, I kind of felt initially quite guilty that I had that with Rex and I didn't have it with Darcy.
Yeah.
But my bond with Darcy is so strong and she's such a lovely little girl and we've got such a lovely little relationship.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You've been
through it together, you know. Like, yeah. And I think that's, you'll never have the same experience with two of them because it is different.
Mm.
But it's so heartwarming to kind of hear that all the preparations you've kind of gone through. It feels like this time has been like, these were where all the holes were. So then second time round, we filled all those holes.
Yeah, totally.
And look how great it was. Yeah. And like, not to suggest that you couldn't have still had issues and that things couldn't have cropped up. Of course you could, but you managed it in a really great way and you faced your fears, which I think is, quite frankly, amazing. I think if anyone had been through that, then they'd kind of be perfectly entitled to say never again.
And I remember thinking that. I remember being in the mother and baby unit and there was a lady there and she was on her third baby and she'd been admitted three times. And I remember thinking, why do you keep doing this to yourself?
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing this? And I just didn't get it. And I thought, you know, I did think back then, I was like, this is really selfish. Why are you doing this? But actually, it wasn't selfish. She got herself to a point where she felt like, no, I can do this. But unfortunately for her, it didn't work out and it wasn't great. And I didn't know her story. I didn't know what everything leading up to this had happened to her.
Yeah.
But since kind of working within the field and doing kind of a lot of work around perinatal mental health, there's so much that can contribute to this.
Yeah.
The transition into becoming a parent is huge. So even if you've not been through a traumatic birth, even if you've not had a, you know, terrible pregnancy, just becoming a parent is massive.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm sure like you would have met people that have kind of had really quite stable lives up until having a baby, and then it all just, their world gets turned upside down.
Yeah.
And that is okay.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it doesn't have to have been really traumatic. And my story is, you know, everyone's story is completely different. And I could have gone through all of that and been fine.
Yeah.
And some people do go through all of that and they are absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And it's just how it impacts us all differently. And it doesn't start at pregnancy. It starts way, way back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, our belief system and our moral compass and where we're at with things. I think it's important for professionals to remember that each person that comes to you, they have a story.
Yeah, yeah. You don't know their story.
Yeah, and I know that we don't have capacity within the NHS to be able to spend loads and loads of time with each individual person, but just those simple questions of checking in and how are you?
Yeah.
And, you know, making that kind of emotional side of things just as important as the physical.
Yeah.
And if baby's weighing a little bit, measuring a bit small, and, oh, okay, baby's measuring a bit small, you know, how does that sentence impact that woman?
Yeah, yeah. You think about the delivery of what you say to people and the impact it has. And I think it's also like you say, you don't know people's journey.
Mm.
And it's quite a skill to give people the benefit of the doubt all the time, you know. So, you know, people do terrible things, have been through terrible things in their life. That doesn't mean it's over for them. It doesn't mean they can't change. It doesn't mean they can't find their way through it, you know. And it just takes, you know, it takes a lot of energy, I think, emotional energy to kind of not pass judgment and not find that. But actually, often, you know, the power that can have in like small sentences, your language and all that, it's subtle, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it makes a huge difference.
And I wouldn't say I was like a massively judgy person before I had children.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I would be really sort of judgmental or, you know, judge a book by its cover, but I didn't have that life experience. So if I saw a homeless person, I wouldn't automatically think, well, how did they get to that point? I'd be maybe thinking, oh my God, please don't come and ask me for money. I'd feel really uncomfortable. But now it fills my mind quite a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do meet people that are on different journeys in their life, but you do see people, you think, oh, you know, I wonder what happened for them to be in this place.
Yeah.
And you do give people the benefit of the doubt, and
it
can be a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes.
Yeah, because you never thought you'd get into those sorts of places, and then suddenly you are, and you can go, okay, well, if I can feel it, they can feel
totally. Yeah. And it's once you've been through an experience, like, it's very hard to judge people.
Yeah And that's a, you know, I think it's a beautiful thing that you take that and you give that to others in a way where you say, you know, you're setting an example.
Mm.
And not just for people that you're supporting, but for your kids and for people around you. You're living that way of life that encourages it in others, you know.
Yeah.
It's infectious, I think, at least, anyway. Mm. It certainly is when I work with you. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, it's been really great, and I'm so chuffed that, like, you know, to know your journey, obviously I did know it before, but to sort of hear it all laid out like that and then to think about, you know, the difference 10 years can make and kind of where you are today. You are a pillar of strength, Holly, and I think it's amazing. So thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so
much.
It's been
a pleasure to have you, and I will... Because you did a video, didn't you? Like an animation for...
Yeah, so Mike did. It was our story from the perspective of the partner.
Yeah.
It's called Mike's Story. And you can, if you Google Mike's Story, Mr. Bins, you'll find it. And I guess as well, just to say, like, anyone listening to this, it feels really scary in the moment. And if it's something you've never felt before, you'll feel like, oh, if I tell anybody, you know, will they take my children away if I've been having these thoughts, or will they not think I'm going to be able to be a good parent? But when you speak to people, that is like the furthest thing away from what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And it's all about, you know, supporting you to be the parent that you want to be. And I would just sort of really encourage people to just be open and honest with how they feel. And it doesn't have to be, you know, to a professional in the beginning, but just someone, just to get that off your chest and say it is really powerful.
Find that place.
Mm.
Yeah. There's some really great snippets of advice. I was kind of mentally noting them all. 'Cause one of the things that I always ask on this is kind of, what advice would you give to others? And I was going through and I was like, when you said about keeping a diary of kind of how far you come, I was like, that's definitely a piece of advice. Yeah. And there's so many little snippets going through it, but it's great to sort of, be able to feed that back to others and learn from it. It's wonderful. So thank you very much for
thank
coming
you so much
on. It's
for
been a real
me.
Privilege.
Thank you.
And we'll share all those links and everything in the show notes. That's it for this week's Born Human podcast. A massive thank you to Holly for coming on and being so honest and so open with us about her story. We did, of course, know each other's stories, but I've never heard it in that detail before. And I guess that kind of links in really nicely with what we're trying to create here at Born Human, which is a space where it is safe to understand your colleagues and share with your colleagues, and that brings a level of human connection that actually adds a lot of value to your relationships at work and allows you to be real and authentic with those that you work with. You know, our days aren't always straightforward, they aren't always easy, and by sharing your stories with others in the right environment, in the right way, then you're able to create those connections, I guess. I think what really inspired me about this particular story was that it was really chronological almost in terms of its delivery and how Holly described it. But there were so many holes and gaps in there of where support was missed, or she could have been dealt with differently, or somebody could have supported her in a different way, and that would have quite clearly changed her outcome. And so I think it's really useful in that context to explain how these kind of situations develop and know that, as we say at Born Human here, it's not about solving the problem once it's happened. It's about getting to root cause and getting it right from the start. So I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. A massive thank you to Holly, as ever, for joining us. And thank you to you guys for joining us, as ever, too. We hope to see you next time on the next Born Human podcast.